As I look out on you, you look like a tired, sore, maybe somewhat frustrated bunch. Did anybody have to shovel some snow? Yeah, okay. You maybe are a little bit tired from all that work. Anybody have a sore back? Yeah, sore backs, tired arms. Anybody? No. Either you have not done the work that I've done, or you are just in much better physical condition than I am. And either one is plausible. So, anyways, I spent some time driving around Stanton the last couple of days, and I've enjoyed seeing what so many people have been able to create out of the snow. How many of you have seen forts and igloos? Yeah, some of them are in your backyards. How many of you have seen snowmen? And not the greatest snow to make snowmen, but I see some hands. People have tried. I heard a story about a snowman this week. Snowmen are kind of known for being round, right? They're rather, you know, they just maybe aren't in the best shape. And this one snowman, he decided that it was time to you know, follow through on his New Year's resolution, and he wanted to lose some weight. So he went to his doctor. You know, everything says on it, you should consult a doctor before you start any exercise or diet program. And, of course, we all consult our doctor before doing so. So this snowman, being a good snowman that he is, went to his doctor, and he said, I want to drop a few pounds. And the doctor outlined this workout program for him. He said, I want you to go out every day and walk briskly around the block. And the snowman said, okay, sure, I can do that. And then the doctor says, and I want you to improve your diet. I want you to replace your noon meal every day with a salad. The snowman thought about this for a little bit. He said, okay, maybe I can do that, but I'm kind of particular about the food I eat. He said, well, what kind of lettuce should I include in this salad? You know, romaine lettuce or spinach? And the doctor looked to him and he said, iceberg. Yes. That has nothing to do with today's sermon. But today we are going to get into some very difficult teachings, some very challenging teachings. And I'm going to say something. I know some of you haven't been coming here long, and I want to just put this out here so you are very aware of it. You may not hear this in any other church in any part of the country, but I'm going to say it today. You don't have to agree with me today. Ooh, are you used to hearing that? No. Now, see, in the Mennonite church, we have this thing called pastoral infallibility, and anything the pastor says is automatically right. No, not so much. I recognize that my fallibility exists. I am human. I make mistakes. What I want to do today is to give you my best understanding, because this is challenging, and there's going to be some things that many of you are going to say, no, I'm just not on board with that today. And I'm trying to remember now, Glenn, you lifted out from that first opening song. What was the one line, please disturb us, God? That may happen today. If you were here during the Sunday school hour, we talked about some very challenging things. And some of the things I say today, you may or may not agree with. And you know what? That is okay. That's okay. Now I'm looking at the clock and it is already 11:05. And I am just going to say right now, I'm not going to be done on time. And I know many of you probably had plans to go to the park and play Frisbee. You might be late. I apologize for that. I'm not going to be able to get into all of these teachings. These are called the antitheses of Jesus, where Jesus says, you have heard it said, but I say unto you. There's a total of 6 antitheses in Matthew chapter 5, 4 in our text for today. There is absolutely no way that I can address all of these in the 30 minutes that I usually speak on a Sunday morning. So if you really want to, we can circle back and address these later. But you know what? In 2 weeks, we're going to be starting Lent. So I feel like we need to keep moving here. So we are not going to look at each of these antitheses because I'm sure that you've probably heard them preached upon before. But what I want to do today is look at the root of these antitheses to see why does Jesus teach these things and how can we read them and interpret them. And I also just want to kind of repent for some of the ways that we as Christians have approached these teachings. Because we as Christians so often, I think, are known for what we are against. You probably hear that in the society around us today. That's kind of this image that people have of Christians. Christians are known for what they are against. So rather than reading today's passage about these difficult teachings from Jesus as viewing them as what we are to be against, I think instead we can get the same general idea, but approaching it differently by looking at what God is for. All right, you ready for that? But before we get into our text this morning, my New Year's resolution, and maybe I should explain this for those of you that have not been here for a while, my resolution is to remind you each and every Sunday morning just how loved you are by God. Because throughout the week, for however many hours there are, we are bombarded with messages of telling us how insignificant we are, how flawed we are, how troubled we are. And if only for 1 hour every week, I want to remind you the same thing that Jesus was reminded when he emerged from the baptismal waters, Stanton Mennonite Church. You are God's children, his beloved. With you, God is well pleased. Keep that in mind as we discuss these difficult things today. So before we get into all those fun teachings, I thought it'd be interesting to do a little walk through later parts of Matthew's gospel. And I want to turn to Matthew chapter 23, beginning in verse 3, the second half of verse 3 through verse 4. This is Jesus speaking. He says, "Do not do what the Pharisees and the teachers of the law do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them." You're familiar with this story, right? Jesus is critiquing these Pharisees for taking the good law that was passed on from Moses and making it more difficult, adding things on top of this teaching. And the reason Jesus has such a problem with this is, well, it was against the law to add to the law. Let's look at Deuteronomy verse chapter 4, verse 2. This is God speaking. Let's read this one together. Everybody, do not add to what I command you. Do I need to explain that? You got that, right? It couldn't be any more clear than that. This is why Jesus has a problem with the Pharisees adding to the law and making it more difficult. God himself says to Moses, do not add to what I command you. You all got that. The people, I'm sure they got that too. But yet, this is what the Pharisees did. Now, I don't have a problem with somebody deciding that they personally need to make adjustments in their life to be more faithful to God. And I want to use the example of driving a car. Now, if we're driving down the road, say the interstate speed limit 70 miles per hour on 81. Driving down 81, let's just say, it might be a fictional story. Let's just say I drive the speed limit. I'm going down 81. I go 70 miles an hour. But when the sun goes down, I intentionally slow down. Because I'm not just a real night person. When it gets late, I get a little groggy. I'm a little bit sleepy. So I might drive 65 miles an hour, even though the speed limit is 70 miles an hour. I'm groggy. I'm not as sharp. I'm not as quick. My reaction time is diminished. Not only that, my vision isn't as good when the sun goes down. When it's dark, I don't see as well. So I take this law, this good law that's meant to protect us, driving at 70 miles an hour, and I go further than that, and I drive 65. Now, I might suggest that you also consider doing that as well. Would you please drive slower when the sun goes down? You can think about it, right? And that's okay. But would it be right for me to say, you must drive 5 miles an hour below the speed limit because I feel it's not safe? Are you comfortable with that? Imagine I have the authority to say, you must do that. Do you like that? No, of course not. You see, there might be some people that actually drive better at night. Some people have problems with, you know, the sun causing them some discomfort with their eyes, and they see better at nighttime than they do during the daytime hours. Some people are more awake at nighttime. Maybe you're working a strange shift at work, and you're just wide awake. As soon as the sun goes down, you're awake. That person is sharper. They're a better driver at night. So it's not right for me to add this rule upon the rule that already exists just because I think it's what's best for me. It's not right. It's okay for me to do it. But to make you do it, maybe some problems there. But this is what the Pharisees were doing. And we know that one of the laws in the Old Testament, one of the Ten Commandments, is to observe the Sabbath. There's certain things that you were not supposed to do. You were not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. And the Pharisees said, well, let's take this good teaching and let's up the ante a bit. So they have this thing in the Bible called a Sabbath day journey. We find that in Acts chapter 1, verse 12. It speaks of the Sabbath day journey. It doesn't say that anywhere in the Old Testament. Nowhere else is it laid out how far a person can walk on a Sabbath day. But someone decided this was the amount that a person could walk. If you go more than that, you're breaking the Sabbath. And that is about a half a mile. Now, somebody else came along, and someone with power and authority decided that, well, I might need to go a mile on a Sabbath. I about said a Sunday. It would have been a Saturday for a Jewish person. They might say, I need to go a mile on a Sabbath day. So someone came up with this idea that if you stop at the halfway point and you have a meal, you can walk another half mile, and you're not taking a one-mile journey. It's two half-mile journeys. It only gets weirder. And don't think I'm making this up. This is real stuff. Someone said, but you can't carry meals with you. You can't carry food with you on the Sabbath because that is work. So, and this is real, folks. I'm not making it up. Someone decided that if a Jewish person needed to travel more than one half mile on the Sabbath day, the day before, they could take food and place it half a mile away and then stop there, eat it, and then go the other half mile. You can see why Jesus was a little uncomfortable with this kind of teaching. These Pharisees were taking this good law that had a purpose, and they were just making it unbearable. People couldn't do these things, right? We wouldn't want to live underneath that kind of a system, would we? Now, those of you that are intuitive know where I'm going here. And the question is, then why does Jesus do it himself? Why does Jesus seem to take a good law? You have heard that it was said. That means Moses said this. It was God speaking through Moses. You have heard that it was said this, but I'm going to make it more difficult. Why is it okay for Jesus to do that, but not the Pharisees? Now, some of you will probably hear me say that and say, well, it's okay because Jesus is God. And some of us are comfortable with that. You know what? I'm actually okay saying that. Jesus is God. Jesus is allowed to add to the law, and the Pharisees weren't because, no, Jesus was perfect. They weren't. But if we just stop there, we miss the point of today's passage. We miss the whole thing that all this is propped up upon. The purpose behind Jesus' teaching of these antitheses is lost if we simply say he's okay to do that because he is God. The example that I use with the children involves something like this. Isn't that a beautiful flower? Oh, it's lovely, unless it's somewhere you don't want it to be. Anybody know what that flower belongs to? That is a thistle, specifically a bull thistle. My wife grew up in Nebraska, and she talks so caringly about this job that she was assigned as a child. She went out through the fields, and her job was to cut down the thistles. So the spring of the year came along. Let's say May was here. Sonia was given the task, and they gave her a large knife of some sort. That's a little scary. They gave her this sword. So when Peter says, is this enough, when he refers to the sword that he has, he was given the assignment of cutting down thistles. That's what it must have been. Anyways, my wife was given the job. Go out in the pasture in May, cut down the thistles. You know what my wife's job was in June? Cut down the thistles again. What did she do in July? Cut down the thistles. August, cut down the thistles. Then you had a few months off. And you know what happened the next year? Cut down the thistles. Now, it would have been so much more work at the time to go in with a shovel or some sort of digging device, unless you had like a backhoe on hand. And who has a... I know one guy here that has a backhoe, but who else has a backhoe to go out and start digging these things up? You could have dug up those thistles and removed them from your property, and hey, problem solved. But it's much more work up front to do something like that, and instead it's easier to send a young woman out with a machete to cut down the thistles. You don't have to pay them in anything but room and board. But what Jesus is doing here is different from what the Pharisees are doing, because the Pharisees are there trying to limit the outward manifestations of these people based upon their own interpretation of the law. But what Jesus is doing is he's redefining and showing the people the purpose of the law. And he's getting to the root of the problem. And yes, indeed, he does make it more difficult. But he's not just putting these rules in place because these rules make them more comfortable or seem to make things just work better. He's trying to get to something much, metaphorically and literally, much deeper than the law. What is the purpose behind the law? Now, like I said, I could spend a lot of time discussing these different teachings of Jesus, these antitheses. But instead, this morning, what I want to do is look at two different questions. First one is, why are ethics important? And the second is, what is God's goal? If you get uncomfortable from sitting down, I should find something to do to stand up, shake it out a bit here. We'll come up with a little exercise later on. But the first one we want to address are, why are ethics important? And just to note, ethics can be used either singularly or as a plural. So if I don't match up my verb and that noun, that's why. Ethics can be singular or plural. Now, just so you're all up to date, you know, ethics is the practice of discerning together what is and is not appropriate to do, what a person ought and ought not to do, what you should and should not do. And everybody, every system has a form of ethics. Every household has ethics in their household. You may, as a family, decide that your family can do this, but not that. And some other household may decide that that is okay, but not this. Now, what we are trying to look at here as the church is some specific form of ethics that we call Christian ethics. We want to know how, as followers of Jesus Christ, we are called to live. What ought we do and what we ought not do. Now, this is a subject of interest to me, so if I get a little deep here, feel free to just put up the stop sign or something here today. But I think that one of the challenges that we see in the church today is that years ago, probably a century or so ago, someone made this false dichotomy between ethics and grace. We all know grace, right? Luther was very articulate. He explained to us that it is through grace that God forgives us. It's not anything that we can do to earn our salvation, nothing we can do to make God love us more. So people took this teaching from Luther and said, well, then why do we need to do these things? And there's this pitting against one another. These people that say you have to follow the rules and follow the teachings, they say that, those that are against that would say that those people are working for their righteousness. This is works righteousness or legalism. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you have those people that say if you don't follow Jesus' words to, you know, every jot and tittle, as the King James tells us, if you don't do that, well, that's libertarianism. That is grace abuse. And I shared a story a couple years ago about my friend John, who grew up in the Amish church. And we laughed a little bit in the Sunday school class as well about this kind of concept. My friend John grew up and he was told as he was growing up in the Amish church that if he ever entered into a bowling alley, God would strike him dead. And this literally, I mean, it scared him for a long time. And he was 50 years old when he finally entered into a bowling alley. He took me with him. I don't know what that means. So John and I and his wife, none of them had ever been to a bowling alley before. We went bowling together. And you know the only thing that was struck down? Were pins. Most of them by John's little wife who beat us all. But we have this dichotomy, this grace versus ethics. Either it's all about God's love and forgiveness for us, there's nothing we can do to make God forgive us, or the other side that says you have to do everything, this every jot and every tittle of the law still applies to us today. And if you know me, you know I don't like those dichotomies. I don't like those easy binaries. What other word can I use here? But that split, I am not comfortable there. I'm somewhere in the middle. Now, I affirm salvation by grace through faith. I do believe that there's nothing we can do to make God forgive us other than to accept that free gift from God. But yet, I also think ethics matter. I also think how we live matters. And I think that's because Christian ethics teaches us how to love God, to love others, and to love one's self. When Jesus was asked, what is the most important law? He said, I can't give you just one. Here's two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, body, strength, all of your being, and love your neighbor as yourself. This summarizes all of the laws and the prophets. These teachings of Jesus, the teachings of the Old Testament, they're all about teaching us how to love God, to give God glory. But it's also about making sure we care for one another and care for ourselves. And just think about these things that Jesus is teaching against here today. You know, one of them says, don't murder. That's a really straightforward one. That's about not hurting someone else. That's how to care for others. But not only that, you're caring for yourself by not murdering someone. Because if you do murder someone, and you've got guilt the rest of your life, you are tearing family and friends apart, you will suffer as well. So I am of the mindset that Christian ethics are about, one, how to bring glory to God, but two, how to love others, and three, how to love ourselves. And this self-love, this isn't narcissism. This isn't just about, you know, looking in the mirror all the time. This is about making sure to care for the life that God gave you here on earth. And I believe that following Christian ethics is the best way to live. If you want to live the fullest life that God has planned for you, you follow these teachings of Jesus. That is about living what Jesus calls the abundant life. I don't think that by doing these things, if you are a follower of Jesus under God's grace, that is what gets you into heaven. And I don't think that slipping up every now and then, that will cause you to be thrown into hell for all of eternity. But if you are following along, you then wonder, what do you do with verses 22b and 30? Anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Anybody here ever call someone else a fool? You don't need to raise your hand. Don't raise your right hand especially. Because anybody here ever stumbled? This is written in the context of anger and lust. We all fall victim to these things. And this is where I'm going to get into the thing that you are very welcome to disagree with me on. But I think that when Jesus says these things, he's not trying to threaten us with eternal punishment at this point. As followers of Jesus, I hope that a little slip up in calling someone a fool isn't going to affect my eternal salvation. Now, I don't think that means that I should go around calling people fools freely or some other verb or noun that means something similar. But what could Jesus mean here? Now, the thing is that when we read through the New Testament, there are two different words that are translated as hell. And the first one is Hades. In Luke chapter 16, this is the story of Lazarus and the rich man. We are told the story about this rich man that didn't care for this man that sat outside of his gates. And when this rich man died, he went to, the word is Hades. And this seems to be some sort of post-mortem separation from God. This is after death that this man is being punished. But the word that's used in today's passage is Gehenna. And it's used 11 times by Jesus, and only one other time in the Bible, in all of the Bible, in the book of James. Now, it is used 3 times in just these antitheses, the passage that we looked at today. And it's in the other two parallels, in Mark and Luke. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, right, there are 9 times that Jesus uses this word, Gehenna. And the thing about Gehenna is that this was a literal place on earth. Just south of Jerusalem, there was this valley, and it was called the Valley of Gehenna. And it had the wonderful reputation of being Jerusalem's garbage dump. Yeah! A garbage dump. So, I mean, we've probably been to the garbage dump before. Have you been to a garbage dump? You've taken things there? Isn't it just a pleasant place to be? No, there are odors, there are smells, there are rats. I don't like rats. There are bugs, there are parasites. There are all sorts of things that I don't even want to, you know, come in contact with. I'm okay with putting my garbage on that truck and letting them take it away. I have no desire to go and visit a dump. But in those days, think of it as being a large valley with a cliff to the side. The Jewish people could just kind of go to the side and they would throw their scraps off into this valley of Gehenna. And in that valley was not only their household waste, but also rotting animal carcasses, perhaps even rotting human carcasses of non-Jewish people just tossed in there. The smell alone is disgusting. But this place was also known because it was a place of perpetual flames. I don't know how else to say it. A perpetual fire in Gehenna. And here's a picture of a garbage dump that is on fire. The Valley of Gehenna. You know, I grew up close to Cleveland, and there was a time when the Lake Erie was on fire. This is kind of even worse. This is a dump that is on fire. It is burning. I wouldn't want to spend any more time there than I would have to, right? You want to get in, you want to get out. It is not pleasant. I believe that when Jesus uses the word Gehenna, that he's not talking about eternal separation from God, but he's talking about hell here on earth. This is the closest thing to hell on earth that we will experience. So this is the metaphor that Jesus chooses. Now, Jesus also talks about post-mortem separation from God, post-mortem hell. The New Testament teaches hell on earth and hell after death. But I think these teachings, when Jesus is talking to his followers, these people under God's grace, I think this is talking about hell on earth. I have worked with pastors, two pastors, as they were fighting, calling one another names, going for the jugular. There was division within their church, and I was asked to do some mediation, to sit down, because these two brothers in Christ, they couldn't be in the same room together. That was hellacious for me, to be in the midst of that. I once was asked to sit with a husband and wife who had not done anything physically wrong. They had not committed the act of adultery, but this husband was involved in viewing pornographic materials. His wife was aware of it. She articulated the way that she felt betrayed, the way that she felt hurt, the way she felt that their relationship was broken because of this decision from this husband. And as I heard him talk about it, he too felt so sad and sorry. He wanted to hurt himself. He talked about committing suicide because of the things that he had done, even though he hadn't actually done anything physically. That was a hell on earth. That felt like a flaming garbage dump to me. There would be any place I would rather be than to be in that room right there, right then. Now, you're welcome to disagree with me, but when I read these teachings of Jesus, when I hear him saying that if you call someone name, or if you lust for someone, that you will be thrown into the fire of hell, I don't see that as being him saying that if you do these things as my followers, even though you're under my grace, that you will be tormented forever. But I'm sure that we've all seen that kind of hell on earth. But let's not stop there. We're out of time. Let's go home. What is God's goal? I think this is the key for understanding these teachings of Jesus. What is God's goal? And if you turn to the book of Genesis, we'll find that early on, God created the earth, and God created it and said, it is good. God created human beings, man and woman. He created them. And he looked out upon all that he had made, and he said, it is good. And God gave human beings the right to do whatever they want, and they took the bad path. And soon the world that God had created and said was good became less good. By the time we come to Genesis chapter 8 and into the early parts of Genesis chapter 9, we find a change, though. This world that God had created and the people made less good is now being blessed in a different way by God. And God makes a promise to the people, and he puts this rainbow in the sky and says, I'm not going to do this destruction anymore. Instead, we're going to go a different route with all of this. And I say this, from Genesis chapter 9 to Revelation chapter 22, it is clear that God is working for and working toward reconciliation. Reconciliation. Now, it's easy to say, well, in this passage here, that's maybe not so much about reconciliation. But the overarching narrative of the Bible is about God trying to make the world good again and to be reconciled to God's people. Now, I'm not one that likes simple definitions, but I kind of like this understanding of what the gospel is. When someone says, what is the gospel? I say, we can be reconciled to God and humanity through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Are we comfortable with that? Can I get an amen? All right, we're going on a good way here, trying to end on a good note. This is the gospel. Through Jesus Christ, we can make things right with our friends, with our neighbors, with our family, and with God Himself. And that's what Jesus is teaching here in these antitheses. He's saying, if you have a gift on the altar for God, if you're trying to make a sacrifice to God, and you remember that a brother or a sister, a person in your church, a person you have this relationship with, if you have something against that person or they have something against you, go and make things right with them first. Leave that gift on the altar. Go and take care of that first. Reconciliation is that important to God. And he goes on and he says, if somebody wants to take you to court and sue you, make things right with that person too. And we miss something there if we don't think about it from a Jewish perspective, because a Jew would have never taken another Jew to court. Early Christianity, these early Christians, they wouldn't have taken another Christian to court. This is reconciliation outside of the church. That's how important reconciliation is to God. So when we read the antitheses of Jesus, these, you have heard it said, but I say unto you, just remember this: murder, name-calling, slander, libel, adultery, lust, breaking the marriage covenant, breaking promises, being untrustworthy, etc., etc., etc. All of these things work against God's goal of reconciliation. All of these things are the opposite of reconciliation. We could spend a lot of time here today talking about what God is against, but I'd rather focus on what God is for. I believe that Jesus Christ is the key to being reconciled, not only to God, but to one another. And if you take nothing else home today, if you don't agree with me on anything else that I said, that is okay. But may we be reconciled through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. May that be our prayer as well. Amen.